It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by our political analysts, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Plenty to chew over, of course, this week, including the Democratic debate, but also this historic day as those articles of impeachment are being transmitted from the U.S. House to the U.S. Senate. We'll get Donna and Jonathan's read on that in addition to a number of other things. But first of all, let's check in with IPR's Clay Masters, a political reporter, also co-host, of course, of the podcast Caucusland from Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Clay.
Hey, good afternoon, Ben.
Last night on the campus of Drake, that last debate among presidential candidates in the Democratic Party before the Iowa caucuses. February 3rd is the date, fast approaching, less than 20 days before that. There were six on the stage who qualified for this debate according to the DNC criteria. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and Tom Steyer. Your observations, what did you make of this final debate, Clay?
Well, so this was the smallest debate stage that we've seen thus far. You know, we've had a lot of these debates and they keep getting smaller and smaller. They're upping the requirements for the poll numbers. And so this was the smallest stage of candidates. And it was also, as many people have pointed out, the least diverse, the whitest stage that of candidates that have been there. There were some specific Iowa points that were made. Mainly, there was one of the reporters from the Des Moines Register, the chief politics reporter there, Brianne Fonensteel, was asking some Iowa questions. But a lot of it was similar stuff that we've seen. There was some sparring between the candidates, but they talked about foreign policy. There was talk about climate change, healthcare, kind of the things that people who have been following this race from over the last year or so are certainly used to hearing from. And, you know, the latest Iowa poll that came out from the Des Moines Register and CNN about a week ago. I guess it's been less than a week. It feels like more than a week ago.
Sure does.
still shows that this is kind of a jump ball. I mean, like, mm-hmm. This is anybody's game right now with Bernie Sanders on top, but also Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, also, you know, all within that margin of error in that next little tier there, and Amy Klobuchar still fighting to stay in there. So this is still a race that, you know, it's been yet to be seen what we're going to make of this debate in Iowa, but I think a lot of people are still just unsure. At least that's what I'm getting when I talk with people who are going to these events.
Right, and we want to reach out this hour to those caucus goers who are undecided to ask what you are weighing in your mind. 1-866-780-9100. Clay, you just echoed what I've experienced too. So many people weighing between two, maybe three different candidates, undecided. Do you have any idea of what are the factors, the chief factors that likely caucus goers are weighing?
Well, I mean, like, the thing that you continue to hear from people when they're like, what do you want in a candidate that will go up against President Donald Trump in the general election? And the thing that unites the party is somebody that's going to beat the sitting president, the Republican president, Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I talked with somebody at an Elizabeth Warren event over the last weekend in Marshalltown who said, I think electability is a farce. And,
right.
You know, there's, you know, what does it mean? And everybody kind of seems to have a different definition of what electability is. But these issues, you know, from immigration to climate change to healthcare, those are the issues that keep coming up. And really, there hasn't been a whole lot of change among the platforms that the candidates are talking about. And so right now, you're kind of seeing these divisions that are being wedged in between, like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, seen as kind of that left lane of the Democratic Party. You're seeing some of that take place. But really, I mean, you go to these things, and I talked to several people over the weekend at different rallies or town halls that were saying, oh, yeah, I'm still trying to figure out if I want to caucus for Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg. You know, like, very different candidates. Really, it's seeming like a personality thing, but people mm-hmm. are, you know, it's bizarre out there. It's much different than it was 4 years ago when it felt very much like a Clinton-Sanders race on the Democratic side, and the Republicans were caucusing then as well. They're still going to caucus this time around, but there was a competitive, you know, open primary, and it was very much a Cruz-Trump kind of thing 4 years ago. So this still feels very wide open, despite a debate just happening to take place in Iowa last night.
Thank you for your views. IPR's Clay Masters, co-host of the podcast Caucusland. Clay, we'll be sure to check back in before caucus day. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Joining us for the rest of the hour, we have the political analysis of Jonathan Hasid, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Ben.
Donna Hoffman is with us, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. She's sitting in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we're looking to our listeners this hour to join us. We are looking for undecided caucus goers. What are you weighing? If you're weighing one, two, three candidates still in your mind, what aspects are most important to you? How will you make that decision? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Let me just broadly ask to start this off with. Donna, you first. What did you make of the final debate last night?
Well, I don't think it moved the needle really for anyone. I kind of view it as a status quo debate, if there is such a thing. You had, you know, I don't think anybody moving that needle. So Biden did as well as he needed to do. That's kind of how he has been doing in these debates. He's holding his own. He's not having any kind of breakout moment, but he's not one that needs a breakout moment. He just needs to kind of maintain where he is. I think Warren had a pretty good night, but she has also had other good debates as well. Buttigieg, I think, was solid again. Maybe he didn't get as much attention as we might have thought he would have gotten. That might hurt him kind of in Iowa in some ways. The same thing with Klobuchar. She didn't really have that breakout moment, mm-hmm. but still was you know, competent. Nobody had any huge gaffes. Not that those things matter enormously anyway. But really, I just think that you saw with that smaller stage a lot of things that you had already seen. A lot of the same issues, although I think it was useful and interesting for voters to have foreign policy lead off the debate. Mm-hmm. That was unusual, and that is obviously an issue that has gotten a little bit more prominence. That tends to help Joe Biden, I think, in this as well. And we did see some contrast with Biden and Sanders on that issue particularly.
Oh, you queued up this bit of audio we have already very nicely, Donna Hoffman. Before we get reaction from Jonathan, let me play this excerpt from last night. Senator Bernie Sanders, former Vice President Joe Biden, asked why they were fit to be commander-in-chief, given that they have both voted yes on wars in the Middle East.
The war in Iraq turned out to be the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of this country. As Joe well knows, we lost 4,500 brave troops. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died. We have spent trillions of dollars on that endless war, money which should go into healthcare and education and infrastructure in this country. Joe and I listened to what Dick Cheney and George Bush and Rumsfeld had to say. I thought they were lying. I didn't believe them for a moment. I took to the floor. I did everything I could to prevent that war. Joe saw it differently.
I was asked to bring 156,000 troops home from that war, which I did. I led that effort. It was a mistake to trust that they weren't going to go to war. They said they were not going to go to war. They said they were just going to get inspectors in. The world, in fact, voted to send inspectors in, and they still went to war. From that point on, I was in the position of making the case that it was a big, big mistake.
In exchange from last night's debate, Jonathan Hasid, with your foreign policy expertise, how do you size up that discussion?
Sanders obviously hammering Joe Biden on his vote to authorize the use of military force in Iraq is a potent sort of talking point that he can use, especially on the sort of left side of the Democratic Party. I mean, what's interesting is the politics of the 2003 invasion have really shifted over the years. You know, now President Trump has called it a terrible mistake. And so it's not just people on the left who sort of rue the decision. And ultimately, this is a millstone around Joe Biden's neck. Now, that said, it's baked in, right? Everybody knows. I agree with basically everything that Donna Hoffman said, that, you know, mm-hmm. this debate isn't going to change anyone's mind. People who knew that Joe Biden voted for the authorization of the use of military force in Iraq in 2003, knew that, you know, 2 days ago, right? I don't think anyone learned anything here about their foreign policy stances.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the run-up to this debate, we had the fight, perhaps too big a word between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And they were asked about whether a woman could be elected president. This week, Warren confirmed a report that Sanders had told her in private that he did not think a woman could defeat Donald Trump. Sanders denied ever saying that. Well, last night, Senator Warren responded to the talk that a woman would not be able to defeat Donald Trump in a general election.
Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women, Amy
so
and
true.
Me. Person on this stage who has beaten an incumbent Republican any time in the past 30 years is me.
Okay. What do you make of that, Donna? How that sort of resolved an issue that popped up a few days ago and was sort of played down last night, wasn't it?
Sure. Well, Warren was obviously prepared for that answer. I mean, she didn't calculate in her head her opponent's, win-loss record right there on the stage, even though she did do a little math when Bernie said, I beat a Republican 30 years ago, which was a little bit humorous. So she was obviously prepared to get that. She obviously did not, as she even said, want to pick a fight with her friend Bernie, and so she did not. It is, though, a looming concern. This is captured in that, listening to Clay earlier, he said something about, a voter he talked to said the electability issue is a farce. This is one of the things, though, that when people sometimes are talking about electability is a way that they are saying, well, Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump, so I don't think I can support a woman in a race, in a rematch against Donald Trump. So there's a gender dynamic that often gets laid into that electability argument. And Warren is trying to downplay that to not make as big an issue of it as maybe the media wanted to do. CNN obviously kind of set that up to maybe get a little bit of excitement, draw a little blood potentially on the stage there. And Warren, did not rise to that. Bernie, essentially did not either. Although, there was a lot made of some of the interaction at the end of the debate between the two of them. I think that's a lot of speculation at this point. But, we have also seen Bernie Sanders on the ground in Iowa, his campaigners anyway, be a little bit more combative with Warren. He pretty clearly, I think, the campaign sees her as one of their major competitors. I think they also see Biden that way as well. But Warren and Sanders are obviously competing for many of the same voters. And so Warren is trying to, alleviate concerns on that that point. And so she got teed up for her, her quip about women can win office.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman with us, Jonathan Haseed, our political scientist on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. If you've just joined us, let's go to our callers. We have callers. Let's quickly sample several callers. Bill is with us in Fairfield. Hi, Bill. Thanks for listening. Are you an undecided caucus goer?
I am somewhat undecided. I'm still trying to figure out, because they're so close one to another as far as policies. I'm fine with just about everybody. But what concerns me the most is how are they going to energize the American people, the broad scope, towards the changes that we're at a point where we really need, and these are big changes, and explain it to them in a way that people will, the average Joe on the street, if you will, to use one of your terms, can understand and get behind the changes that they want to project and make happen.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm
looking
worried
for,
about that.
You're looking for the candidate, and by your comment, I say it's not evident to you which candidate is the one with the most energy.
I didn't see that last night. I didn't think that. I think constantly making the field smaller and smaller and smaller is doing a disservice to us. But that's not a surprise from the Democratic National Group.
Okay. Thank you, Bill in Fairfield. Let's jump over to Tom in Des Moines. Tom, quickly, you're undecided. What are you weighing?
Yes, I'm looking for someone on the moderate end of the spectrum. It's interesting that Elizabeth Warren is saying that electability is not a big issue since she's on the end of the spectrum that's not terribly electable. So I'm looking for someone who has good instincts, and of course that's hard to read. I mean, if you were a politician asking me what is it that you want in a candidate, you'd normally be asking me, what buttons can I press? And then I would tell you, if I was a typical voter, what buttons you can press. But I'm trying to avoid that symbiotic relationship with our politicians. I'm trying to read between the lines and find out whose instincts can I trust in certain situations. It sounds like all these guys and women are running for dictator. And Elizabeth Warren says, I have a plan for that. Well, right. I'm not looking for people with endless plans, because those plans are not going to be implemented. They have to be compromised all along the line. So we're not looking for people who have full-blown plans, because they're not going to be implemented. We're looking for people who have the right instincts.
Mm-hmm. Tom, thank you for that in Des Moines. It sounds like you're a little bit out of the Buttigieg playbook there. He's constantly in a refrain of, it doesn't matter what your dreams are if you can't get it done. I know others do that as well. Kay is in Waterloo, our last caller for the moment. Kay, quickly, what are your thoughts? As I assume an undecided caucus goer.
Yes, yes, indeed, undecided. I will be going, not endorsing or caucusing for anybody who is already a senator. We Democrats need every Democratic senator that we have, and taking one out reduces our ability to manage the Senate and to get anything through. I think it dissipates our energy and our ability to govern. So we need all our Democratic senators, and my caucusing will be for somebody who is not a senator. I have not yet decided which one.
Kay, thank you very much for your thoughts from Waterloo. Jonathan Hasid, to you first. We heard a battery of responses. They're very different, interesting responses when we're asking our listeners, caucus goers, what they're weighing. What is your reaction?
You know, the first two callers really echoed what Clay Masters was saying, which is that everyone's looking for electability, right? The first caller, Bill, said that we need a candidate who can energize people, who can inspire. And Tom echoed this with his the second caller, with his plea for inspiration, right? Instinct. In both cases, you know, it's hard to know what these look like, and so this is everyone's still looking around for the magic electable candidate, right? This is people in the Democratic Party seem to mostly agree on a lot of the major issues. I mean, they disagree on the details of, say, healthcare reform, but everybody on the left seems to agree that it needs to happen. And so the fights that are happening are mostly are not so much about, I mean, there are policy fights, but they're not as important as the fights about individual personality. And I guess no one, as the polling shows, you know, no one has yet decided who has these instincts or who can energize the population.
Donna, that's interesting too. You know, when Jonathan says, well, maybe it's not about as much issues as personality, that would be the explanation for what Clay mentioned as well. When we talk about someone weighing the difference between should I be support Warren or Buttigieg, two very different issue-wise candidates, right?
Right. So I think that we will see at the point that it's clear who the Democrats are going to nominate. The party coalesced behind that person. That's one of the reasons why you didn't get the drawing blood on the stage in Des Moines last night, because the party doesn't want to be too divisive in this stage. Sometimes that can happen, because at the end of the season, we as a party, meaning the Democrats, have to come together behind who that nominee is. And there seems to be a really strong desire among Democrats to debate the issues now, Medicare for all, Medicare for some, et cetera. But at the end of the day, that might not matter as much as, can this person really beat Trump? And the excitement that I think Tom from Des Moines was saying he's not exactly seen might come, because that may be the thing that energizes Democrats. Right now, they're divided in the sense of looking these candidates over. But once there is a clear nominee in that sense, Democrats have to come together behind that person. And then the one opponent is Trump. And then the contrast there can be more clear, more decisive in terms of where this person wants to go on policy.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Terry in Cedar Rapids. Terry, welcome to our program. I understand you're undecided as well. Quickly, we're coming up to a break. What are your thoughts?
Well, so last election, I went to caucus for Bernie Sanders. What I felt like the Democratic Party did upset me, so I ended up not even going and voting for the Democratic Party in the election. Now, I'm undecided. I was supporting Tulsi Gabbard at the beginning. I didn't like how she handled the impeachment. And so now I'm leaning a lot more towards Sanders and Warren, and it seems like Sanders is getting the momentum. But I'm going to go to caucus, and I'm just going to see where the most people are, and I'm going to join them because I just want somebody that's going to win this time.
Okay, we get back to that electability. Terry in Cedar Rapids, thank you very much. An undecided Democrat, or I guess could be an independent voter as well. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
And before we go to break, of course, we're going to talk about impeachment, the impeachment trial in the second half hour. It's expected to begin as early as January 24th, less than 2 weeks before the Iowa caucuses. Now, four senators, two of them front runners in this race for the Democratic nomination for the will leave the campaign trail next week. They have to sit in judgment of President Trump. I wonder, Jonathan, how will this shape the final days of the campaign before the caucuses? We have Senators Klobuchar, Sanders, Elizabeth Warren heading back. They must, they're duty bound to head back to Washington in the midst of this campaign.
That's right. I mean, it's going to take them off the trail, most obviously. And so I imagine that Mitch McConnell is probably pretty happy about the timing of that, taking them off the trail right before the Iowa caucuses. You know, that said, it's sort of hard to know how much it will matter because, of course, they'll be, I mean, yes, they won't be, you know, pressing the flesh at town hall events, but they will be, you know, nationally at a nationally televised impeachment hearing, presumably making speeches and being visible. So, you know, they may well get just as much national attention that way as they would have gotten on the trail. But to the extent that they're off the trail, I got to think it helps at least marginally, you know, Joe Biden, who's who, of course, will not be, you know, presiding over the impeachment trial and, you know, will be free to campaign on his own schedule.
Donna Hoffman, we have about 30 seconds before we go to break. Does this, in your view, disadvantage Klobuchar, Sanders, Warren?
It does a bit, but they all have organizations in the state, and that's going to, you know, be something that they're going to have to rely on to carry over. They certainly have ads that they can do, which they've already been doing in that sense. So it's not as if the campaigning will stop. And it may even spur their volunteers to double down and get out there and knock on those doors. And that is one of the effective things related to organizing that we know works in the Iowa caucuses.
Donna and Jonathan, stay in your seats in your respective studios. And listeners, please stay in your seats. Maybe it's a car seat. We have plenty more Politics Wednesday ahead for you. Donna and Jonathan will be back after a short break. We'll talk about the historic day in the impeachment process, those articles of impeachment being transmitted today from the U.S. House to the U.S. Senate. We'll talk about what's happening and the significance of today and get our guests to look forward to this trial in the Senate. I'm Ben Kiefer with Donna Hoffman and Jonathan Hasseed. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, of course, today with us, Donna Hoffman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Jonathan Hasseed, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. To join our conversation as this hour we move into the impeachment process, a historic day, the articles of impeachment being transmitted from the U.S. House to the Senate as we speak. I'm looking at goings-on in the U.S. House now on my monitor. There are votes there taking place right now. It's expected later this afternoon that Pelosi and the managers will hold a ceremony, I think around 5, 4 o'clock our time, and they will march those articles of impeachment across the Capitol to deliver the charges. Let's listen to Nancy Pelosi from earlier this morning in a press conference she held with other members of the U.S. House, addressing the media about the significance of this decision to move the articles of impeachment to the Senate for an impeachment trial.
This is about the Constitution of the United States, and it's important for the president to know and Putin to know, the American voters in America should decide who our president is. Not Vladimir Putin in Russia. So today I'm very proud to present the managers who will bring the case, which we have great confidence in terms of impeaching the president, and his removal, but this further evidence insists that, and we wouldn't be in this situation had we not waited, insists that there be witnesses and that we see documentation. And now you see some of that change happening on the Senate side. I hope it does.
Also, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, spoke this morning. He addressed why impeachment must continue into a trial in the Senate as soon as possible.
We couldn't wait because, I mean, some people said, well, you know, let the election take care of it. He's trying to cheat in that election. So it is essential that we bring this impeachment to stop the president from trying to rig, not from trying, he tried, from rigging the next election, from conspiring with a foreign government, as the Russian government attempted to rig our last election. The evidence is overwhelming. The latest evidence with Parnas and Giuliani makes it even more so.
Okay, now let's address that new evidence which surfaced yesterday in our news, Donna and Jonathan. House Democrats releasing records detailing of how Donald Trump's associates pushed Ukrainian officials to investigate his political rivals. Dozens of pages of notes, text messages of the work that conducted by Rudy Giuliani, his personal lawyer, and his associate Lev Parnas on behalf of the president. Even a scrawled note on a sheet of hotel paper there. Jonathan, what do you make of these latest developments, together with the fact that these articles are now being transmitted today? We'll be there by the end of the day, it seems.
I mean, the new evidence is damning, but it doesn't really tell us anything we didn't already know. I mean, the evidence that the president pressured Ukraine to investigate his domestic political opponent is overwhelming. Even Republicans mostly acknowledge that it happened. It's just a question of whether or not it's improper enough to result in impeachment. That said, this is, you know, further evidence. Apparently, there's some memos from Rudy Giuliani saying explicitly that he's acting on behalf of President Trump, the president of the United States, when he's asking Zelensky for favors.
Mm-hmm.
And so this basically confirms what everybody knew. There's also, potentially, I think the more interesting development would be the testimony, if it happens, of John Bolton, who was Trump's national security advisor for a while, and who for a while signaled that he wasn't willing to testify, but in the past few weeks has suddenly, for whatever reason, has changed his mind and said that if he's subpoenaed, he will testify. And so that's going to put that and the Parnas evidence developments are going to put more pressure on the few persuadable Republican senators to allow witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Donna, is this getting to the point where it's anywhere near the pressure needed on Republicans make them vote to include witness testimony, additional documents?
Well, I think you have some of the senators signaling a little bit of, they're holding back, in particular. You have Mitt Romney saying at least initially he wouldn't vote for witnesses, but he might be open to it later. Susan Collins, Lamar Alexander, some of the senators that we might be watching in that sense. But, you know, one of the things to note here is Nancy Pelosi's decision to delay the transmission of the articles of impeachment until obviously today. You know, had those been done earlier, immediately after the vote that took place in mid-December, so it's been basically, a month. You could have had some interesting dynamics in the Senate. You, for example, could have potentially had a quick dismissal vote in the Senate. Nancy Pelosi didn't do that. And there was a lot of questioning, I think, of her strategy here. There is even some speculation that she actually lost because she didn't get McConnell to say, yes, we will agree to call witnesses yet, because that's still an open question.
Mm-hmm.
But what you did get here is in the interim, over this period of time, over the holidays, people contemplating things, the Bolton information coming out, now this new Parnas information coming out, and a steady kind of drip, 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 drip of more information. And again, nothing incredibly new here, but further bolstering the claims that have been made, like we now see with this Giuliani letter that surfaced in this information coming from the House Intelligence Committee yesterday. But there's another thing that was in that evidence, too, that we haven't yet talked about, and that is Maria Yovanovitch, who was the Ukrainian ambassador that was very quickly hustled out of the country, dismissed seemingly from pressure. We get more information on this, but we also get an inkling of a notion here that maybe the people around Giuliani were surveilling her. And this is going to spark another investigation in the House, it appears, this because she's a State Department official, obviously. The Foreign Affairs Committee in the House is probably going to be asking the State Department for documents, asking the State Department for more evidence of this, because this is a related but separate thing. And so it's a good thing to also think about that the House committees continue their investigation of the Trump administration on a number of different fronts, and it involves foreign affairs, foreign service, or financial services, mm-hmm. oversight and reform, and these things are ongoing and have been ongoing, and were even hinted at in an earlier resolution where some of this was laid out earlier in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a many pronged octopus, and things keep helping the Democrats in this sense, and then further putting pressure on Republican senators the mm-hmm. longer we go.
Right. And at issue here in this instance with these articles of impeachment, the charges that the president pressured the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, to announce investigations of his political rivals, and then obstructed congressional investigations of these actions. Of course, a good number of Republican senators would have to do something quite different in terms of their stance to change the math in the Senate, Jonathan. Specifically, we haven't talked about our two GOP senators, Senators Ernst and Grassley. They have been backing Mitch McConnell up to this point. In fact, Senator Ernst is often standing quite prominently pictured behind McConnell's shoulder during McConnell's exchanges with the press at the Capitol. Do you see that as likely, or what can you tell us about the position of our U.S. senators here in Iowa?
They'll follow the rest of the GOP. It's with the amount of evidence that we have, it's obviously Trump's conviction and removal by the Senate is extremely unlikely. I mean, the only possible scenario where that could take place is if there's a secret ballot, if some kind of new extraordinary evidence emerges and there's a secret ballot for the senators. I think that's the only realistic possibility of Republican senators publicly turning on the president. So barring that very unlikely event, Senators Grassley and Ernst are almost certainly going to vote to acquit.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on, Donna, what can we expect in the coming days in terms of how this trial in the Senate will proceed?
Well, so we know that the House managers this afternoon sometime, we believe, will walk those articles over. Likely Senator Grassley will be presiding because he's president pro tem of the Senate. So we probably would expect him to be the one to receive those in as he's the presiding officer in the Senate. And then from there, it appears that nothing much will happen substantively until it looks like Tuesday after Martin Luther King Day next week, where you then will the schedule will get a little bit more clear. So we're going to have the House managers present their case, the president's lawyers present their defense. And then from there, what happens procedurally is a little bit up in the air. Also, I should mention in here that at some point, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will be notified that these articles have been transmitted to the Senate, and the Senate's going to start their trial because the Chief Justice has to preside at that, although that's largely that's not a role in which he's going to be probably all that visible, although he will be center stage, but it is
more
kind of a procedural, more ceremonial. Mm-hmm. Now, he will have to rule on some things. The Senate can vote to overturn those rulings. Unlikely that that would happen. But there is, recognized here, not a lot of precedent to fall back on when we look at how the Senate functions here, because the Senate hasn't done very many of these when it involves the president, of course. And so we know how things in the past have worked. We know where they're probably is some leeway, and there are still yet a lot of things to be developed.
Okay, in the final 10 minutes of our program, let's jump to a couple of other items. So many items in our news worthy of discussion that we just haven't been able to discuss in the weeks and months of Politics Wednesday because of the impeachment developments here. Let's talk about Iran. Jonathan, to you on this. First of all, protesters have staged daily rallies in the capital of Iran, Tehran, and other cities in Iran since this past weekend. On Saturday was when, after days of denials, the Iranian authorities admitted to bringing down a Ukrainian plane last week, killing all 176 aboard. When we look at it from the vantage point a week later, what are the lasting political repercussions of this tragedy?
I mean, it certainly doesn't make the Iranian government and armed forces look good for their domestic audience, and this is why, in part, why we're seeing protests. I've seen some people suggest that perhaps this is Iran's Chernobyl moment. That is the moment when, inside the Soviet Union, when the reactor melted and sort of they denied for a while, and then they admitted it, and it was seen as a big sea change in public opinion toward the regime. I'm not sure I would go that far. You know, there are protests against the Iranian regime for various things periodically. It's hard to know exactly how popular the Iranian government is with its people. But there's sort of conflicting reports on crowd size. Some people say that these protests are not enormous. Others say they're very large.
Interesting, though, that they're being allowed to happen. I mean, there's evidently was shots fired. There are police authorities controlling the protesters, but they are happening, right? That's something.
Sure. You know, Iranian politics is very complicated, and there are a lot of different factions inside the Iranian political structure, the power structure. And no doubt these protests work to the advantage of some factions that are, you know, the ones not in power. And so I suspect that there's a lot of jockeying over who gets to use force. I suspect that the Iranian government, parts of it, the hardline elements would like to crack down, but perhaps for internal political reasons that are a mystery to us, cannot do so.
Mm-hmm. From your vantage point, Donna, how do the events of the past couple of weeks, including the U.S. drone strike that killed this top Iranian commander in Iraq, how does that change the confrontation, in your eyes, between Iran and the Trump administration?
Well, one of the interesting things that I think it presents, both to external audiences but to domestic audiences here as well, is the debate and the complicated debate over presidential war powers. And so, you know, we had action in the House earlier where they passed a non-binding resolution related to war powers. We're going to see potentially next week also at the same time the Senate's doing the impeachment trial, because the morning can still be reserved for Senate business. We may see a resolution that would be a binding resolution from Senators Kaine and Lee. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. We already know there's, and this was referred to by, I think, Amy Klobuchar in the debate last night, mm-hmm. four Republicans that will sign on to that debate, reminding the president essentially that if you're going to do military action in Iran, you have to come to the United States Congress. This is a perennial tug of war between the president and Congress, because the founders divided up the war power. They gave the president commander-in-chief power, but they gave Congress the ability to fund war, but also to declare war. And so this presents then to other countries, in particular Iran, you know, a glimpse into the domestic politics of the United States that can be read in a lot of different ways. And that's one of the tea leaves that sometimes you have to read.
Mm-hmm. We have those Republican senators, Mike Lee, you mentioned, of Utah, but also Susan Collins, Todd Young of Indiana, Rand Paul of Kentucky. So that brings the total number of supporters for the measure in the Senate to 51. It's a simple majority that is needed for passage here. But Donna, that's not veto-proof, is it?
It's not. Now, Kaine was, I believe Kaine and Lee had an op-ed today. They think they might be able to pick up some more Republicans. This mirrors, in some respects, an earlier resolution of this type over the war in Yemen. That, of course, did pass, was sent to the president, and the president vetoed it. You know, so again, probably this is unlikely to get veto-proof margins in either chamber, but it still makes a statement on the part of the Congress that this is something that they want the president to be on notice for.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, in the last few minutes here, I wanted to swivel over to your area of expertise, Asia, and talk about this recent election in Taiwan. Today, the president of Taiwan urged China to review its policy toward the island coming days after Xi won a landslide re-election victory. Give us some background about this election, what was on the ballot, so to speak, and what the outcome means for Taiwan and its relationship with China.
Sure. So Tsai Ing-wen, who won re-election, as you said, with a I think 57% of the vote, enormous turnout. This was a really surprising result, given where she was last year. So her popular opinion ratings were in the 20s just a year ago. She was seen as deeply unpopular, extremely unlikely to win re-election. But basically what happened was Hong Kong. The protests in Hong Kong and the Hong Kong government's heavy-handed response, the use of tear gas, the mass arrests, the domestic threats and so forth, really seem to have shifted public opinion in Taiwan. So Taiwan, for the listeners who don't know, is an independently governed island claimed by China as Chinese territory. Many in Taiwan would disagree. They have their own political system. And basically the protests in Hong Kong seem to put in sharper focus the Chinese threat for Taiwanese voters. And so it seems like many people who didn't like Tsai last year, this year saw her, and particularly her party, as being a force that stands up for Taiwanese rights and potentially her party at one point no longer has, but at one point officially was for Taiwanese independence. This was quite a long time ago. But still, her party, the DPP, is seen as the sort of pro-Taiwan rights and pro-Taiwan independence party. The person she beat from the KMT was widely seen as friendlier to China.
And has Taiwan, and it calls itself the Republic of China, to be a little bit confusing here, has it ever been part of mainland China?
Yes, it has been from the Qing Dynasty. So from around 1600 until the late 1890s, it was a very sparsely populated border province.
Okay.
Then it was a Japanese colony between 1896 and 1945. And then it was only united politically with mainland China for 4 years in the 20th century, between 1945 and 1949. After 1949, Taiwan was independently governed, which is where it remains today.
Mm-hmm.
So, for the last 150 or so years, Taiwan has really politically been a part of mainland China for only 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So China considers Taiwan to be part of China proper. The Taiwanese just voted saying no, overwhelmingly. That's not what we think. What is the U.S. stance on Taiwan these days?
The U.S. stance on Taiwan is complicated. The governing U.S. law here is the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, which mandates that the U.S. be involved with Taiwanese affairs, and that the U.S. sell arms to Taiwan of a, quote, defensive character. Now, the Trump administration has just approved the sale of a bunch of F-16Vs, the V version, to Taiwan in a large deal. The first President Bush also sold Taiwan a bunch of F-16s. I don't know that these count as of a defensive character. But nonetheless, governing U.S. law, which is still good law, says that it is, Taiwan's concerns are the U.S. concerns. And when China threatens Taiwan, the U.S. tends to react to back Taiwan up. So most recently, in 1996, China fired a whole bunch of missiles off the coast of Taiwan during that presidential election of that year. Then-President Bill Clinton sent two U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups sailing through the Taiwan Strait in a kind of a show of force.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had anything as dramatic since, but the Trump administration has signaled that it wants to sell increasingly competent and expensive military hardware to Taiwan over Beijing's objections.
Mm. Jonathan, thank you for your expertise on that. Donna, before we part here, anything in particular? Of course, impeachment and the caucuses to be watching in the coming days. Anything, a final thought to add before we say goodbye today?
Well, it's certainly a very active time. And, as presidential candidates leave the state on February 4th, we'll have the State of the Union address,
yes,
presumably to look forward to as well.
So we've got the State of the Union address, February 4th, February 3rd, of course, the caucuses, and then overlaying all of this, we have the impeachment process. Wow. This is politics through a fire hose for you to dissect for us. Thank you so much, Donna Hoffman and Jonathan Hasid. Donna Hoffman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Jonathan Hasid, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jonathan and Donna, thank you so much for coming into our studios today.
Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on the program, Andrew Yang. I'll have a conversation with the former tech entrepreneur who is a Democratic presidential candidate, a conversation recorded yesterday with Andrew Yang tomorrow on the program. Also, I'll talk with Sue Otto. She has just returned from the U.S.-Mexican border after assisting refugees waiting to be granted asylum. She'll tell us about her experiences. She's gone more than once on the border, assisting asylum seekers on the U.S.-Mexican border. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.